Good afternoon, or good morning, to those of you on the West. Welcome to the Talking Freight Seminar Series. My name is Nicole Cooney, and I will moderate today's seminar. Today's topic is an overview of MARAD's Strong Ports program. Before I go any further, I do want to let those of you who are calling into the teleconference for the audio know that you need to mute your computer speakers, or else you will be hearing the audio over the computer as well. Today, we'll have five presentations given by Roger Bonnert, United States Transportation Marine Administration; John Young, the American Association of Port Authorities; Ben D'Alba of the California State Transportation Agency; Rob Case of the Hampton Roads Transportation Planning Organization; and Jeff Lorne of the Virginia Port Authority. Roger Bonnert is the Deputy Associate Administrator of the Office of Intermodal System Development. He assists in developing policy and programs aimed at reducing congestion, removing barriers to the efficient movement of freight and passengers, and environmental sustainability. Roger leads the agency's implementation of the new Strong Ports program aimed at helping the nation's ports meet their modernization and expansion needs, and is also the agency lead for the Transportation Investments Generating Economic Recovery, TIGER, grants program, which has allocated over $500 million to port and marine transportation projects since 2009. John Young is the director of the Freight and Surface Transportation Policy at the American Association of Port Authorities. While his primary responsibilities are covering freight and surface transportation policy issues, he also covers port security in the Department of Commerce's Supply Chain Initiative. Previously, John acted as a legislative director in the U.S. Congress for two members on the House Transportation and Infrastructure Committee, where he created the Bipartisan Goods Movement Caucus that developed the projects of national and regional significance legislation that was considered and included in Safety Lou. He has worked on and advocated for numerous transportation issues ranging from reauthorization of Safety Lou and MAP 21 to aviation, Coast Guard, port security, and water policy issues. Ben D'Alba is Assistant Secretary for Rail and Ports at the California State Transportation Agency. He serves as an advisor to the Secretary on key freight-related issues. Ben also serves as the Secretary's representative on a number of boards and commissions, including the Board of Pilot Commissioners for the Bays of San Francisco and the California-Mexico Border Relations Council. In addition, in collaboration with the California Department of Transportation, Ben guides and directs the California Freight Advisory Committee. Robert B. Case is the Principal Transportation Engineer with the Hampton Roads Transportation Planning Organization, where he leads a team of engineers to analyze the costs and benefits of mega projects, evacuation projects, maintenance, public transportation, and active transportation. Dr. Case is a licensed professional engineer in Virginia, a registered professional traffic operations engineer, and an ASCE fellow. He is an adjunct instructor at Old Dominion University, where he has taught transportation fundamentals, transportation planning, and preparation for the PE exam. Jeffrey F. Lorne is the Vice President of Port Development for the Virginia Port Authority. He joined the Port Authority in 2002 as a chief engineer to lead the port's largest capital development program, resulting in completion of the 50-foot channel, redevelopment of NIT, the port's largest container terminal, and the federal approval of 600-acre eastward expansion of Craney Island. Jeff's work at the Port Authority has focused on expanding capacity at the third largest port on the East Coast to accept the anticipated increase in freight coming through the expanded Panama Canal. He has led the way on projects designed to improve intermodal operations at the port and to make freight movement more efficient while providing economic benefits to Virginia. Today's seminar will last 90 minutes, with 60 minutes allocated for speakers and the final 30 minutes for audience question and answer. If during the presentation you think of a question, you can type it into the chat area. Please make sure you send your question to everyone and indicate which presenter your question is for. Presenters will be unable to answer your questions during their presentations, but I will start off the question and answer session with the questions typed into the chat box. If we run out of time and are unable to address all questions, we will attempt to get written responses from the presenters to the unanswered questions. The PowerPoint presentations used during the seminar are available for download in the File Download box in the lower right corner of your screen. The presentations will be available online within the next few weeks, along with recordings and transcripts. I will notify all attendees once the materials are posted online. Talking Freight seminars are eligible for 1.5 certification maintenance credits for AICP members. In order to obtain credits for today's seminar, you must have logged in with your first and last name, or if you're attending with a group of people, you must type your first and last name into the chat box. I've included more detailed instructions in the file share box on how to obtain your credits after the seminar. For those of you who are not AICP members but would like to receive PDH credits for this webinar, please note that FHWA does not formally offer PDHs. However, it may be possible to receive PDHs for your participation in Talking Freight if you are able to self-certify. To possibly receive PDHs, please download the agenda from the File Download box and submit this agenda to your respective licensing agency. Finally, I encourage everyone to please also download the evaluation form in the File Share box and submit this form to me after you have filled it out. I'm now going to turn over to Roger Bonnert of the U.S. Department of Transportation Maritime Administration to get started.
Great. Thank you, Nicole. Good afternoon, everyone. I'd also like to thank our partners at the Federal Highway Administration, especially Caitlin Raymond and the freight team over there. We work hand-in-hand with those folks, and it's a superb partnership. Talking Freight here is a great tool to collaborate with our partners. We appreciate the opportunity to use it as a platform today. I was looking over the sign-up list for today's call, and it was really impressive. We've got a lot of ports, a lot of states and state DOTs, regional entities, folks that I think are just perfect for this kind of a dialogue. So we really recently enlisted the help of a firm to help us work on a new national maritime strategy, which is one of our agency's top priorities for the year. As part of that, they talked to about 60 different stakeholders and asked them what they think the Maritime Administration should be doing for the industry and for freight. And we just got a debrief from them a couple days ago, and interestingly, the single strongest response we got was that they think the Maritime Administration should be an integrator. So the subject of today's webinar is perfect because really it's all about integrating ports into the state and local planning processes so that we look at this as a system instead of a bunch of standalone activities as we move forward. I'm going to talk briefly today about strong ports and the thinking behind how we put the program together. Then I'm going to turn the floor over to my colleagues on the panel. I think they're going to give you excellent examples of how they're integrating ports from the national level, the state level, the regional, and the port perspectives. Before I get started, though, one public service announcement. I'll probably mention the acronym MPO several times. Please consider that to be synonymous with councils of governments, regional planning organizations, rural planning organizations, municipalities, or any other planning organizations below the state level. So please don't view that as me singling out one type of regional planner, but not another. So let's get started. I think the first thing we should talk about is why should we care so much about ports? And you can see on this slide at the macro level that the gross domestic product, or the state of our economy and prosperity, which is one of these two lines on the chart, and our international trade go hand in hand. And you can see even when there's a glitch in one, there's a glitch in the other. So what this really means at the national level is that international trade drives the economy. And anybody familiar with our port network knows that something on the order of 99% of our overseas trade by volume moves through our ports. So the ports are critical. And that's a great macroeconomic thing and all that, but what does it mean to the folks on the phone? Well, if you look, and we just picked a couple of ports for examples, almost every single port in the country has done an economic impact study, and you can see that the importance of ports to their own community, to their state, and to their region is substantial. substantial in numbers of jobs and in dollars. So the ports on a national level, all the way down to the local community, are really, really significant. But we kind of face a problem, and that is that the ports are really a silent engine. In spite of the fact that they drive productivity, they drive the economy, and they drive jobs, most people don't know what they do unless they stop doing it. So this talk is about how do we make sure that they're ready for the present and for the future. And the ports face challenges. We've seen in the news a lot about the West Coast. Only part of that problem had to do with labor. A lot of it had to do with various components that were causing congestion. On the East Coast a couple of years ago, Superstorm Sandy created problems. There were chassis problems, terminal and gate delays, and other congestion. And we have a lot of aging infrastructure. Many of the ports in the U.S. were built in the 1950s to the 1970s. So many of them have been due for more than just a facelift. And if you look forward, we've got a couple of real challenges we're facing on top of that. One is a growing population. By 2045, our population is going to grow by 70 million people. The experts predict that that's going to drive freight volumes up by something on the order of 45%. That's a big challenge. How do we address that if the ports are already kind of nearing their limits? In 2010, Congress directed us to address this in the Defense Authorization Act. They directed the Secretary of Transportation to establish a port infrastructure development program for the improvement of port facilities. That's what we're calling strong ports, just because it's easier to remember. So I want to talk a little bit about how we approach the task of implementing this program. And what we learned was that any project has a continuum, and it doesn't matter if you're putting a new deck on the back of your house or building a large infrastructure project in a port. You must follow the continuum that starts with planning and engagement with stakeholders, goes on to deal with the financing and financial strategies, and then project execution. And we found that ports are unique in a lot of that, and that we have opportunities in each of those categories that I'll talk about separately to help ports kind of catch up. We realize that ports are not all part of an integrated planning process. A lot of this came out when we saw the ratio of ports that got Tiger grants compared to other applicants, you know, highways, transit systems, and so forth. And we realized that the ports haven't been planning under, you know, legislative mandates for, you know, 20 or so years. So for planning and engagement, we really saw that we have a lot of opportunity to help ports kind of catch up. And some ports are fabulous at it. Some of the bigger ports have, you know, great planning staffs and all that. Some smaller and medium ports, a little less so. A couple of the things we're doing here, and this is with our colleagues on with the Association of Port Authorities, and John Young will be speaking after me, is a port planning and investment toolkit. We rolled out in November our first piece, which is on financing. We're working on the second one now that's planning. Other ones that are in the queue will be public-private partnerships, project execution, and others as the needs arise. But we realized that there wasn't a broad kind of planning for dummies out there for ports. So working with AAPA, we did that. Here in the Maritime Administration, we, in the last year or so, hired Barb Nelson, who's from an MPO, so that we could learn more of how surface transportation planning works. And Barb's putting together our Port Talk program series, which is one of the more formal ways we can help ports, MPOs, state DOTs, and other stakeholders come together and get the ports into the transportation planning process. The second one is financing. What we're finding here is that there are very few simple financing strategies anymore. They're all becoming joint ventures of one form or another, where there's port money mixing with state regional, private in some cases, and federal. So we're working with the with the ports through a couple of mechanisms. Obviously, Tiger grants, but that only takes you so far. We're also working with the new Build America Transportation Investment Center, which is helping helping entities, including ports, put together these joint financing ventures. We've got 7 ports we're working with right now, with several others in the queue on that, to help them identify funding mechanisms. We're trying to see if we can help with things like TIFIA, for those of you who know the acronym, rail funding, CMAQ, and some of those other mechanisms, to be part of this sort of pie chart that can collectively help fund projects inside and outside of the port. Lastly is project support. We're helping some individual ports with how to manage projects. And of course, we're working with, we have about 40 ports or so that are involved in the Tiger Grant Program. We're helping them. And that Transportation Investment Center ports, that's actually sort of a cradle-to-grave type thing. So we'll be working with them right through the completion of the construction project. There's a lot more we're doing with the Strong Ports program now, and we've got several new initiatives that are in the queue for the future. We've got a website, strongports.gov, and I'd encourage you to visit that from time to time to see what we've got going on now and what else is coming down the road. And as I understand it, we'll have time for questions after the panel, so I'll yield the floor, and thank you for the opportunity to talk to you today. Thanks.
Thank you, Roger. We'll now move on to John Young of the American Association of Port Authorities. John?
Thank you, Nicole. And thank you, Roger, for that presentation. As my presentation comes up, I just want to, you know, for those of you who aren't familiar with the American Association of Port Authorities, we are the unified voice of the seaport industry here in D.C. We have over 300 members, including the major seaports in the country, as well as DOTs, as well as engineering companies, as well. We are very active on the Hill. We on Monday, we just did a Ports 101 briefing for about 60 people, staff, press. Our ports that presented there were New York, New Jersey, Los Angeles, Houston, Virginia, and our board president this year from Port Hueneme, Kristen Dekas, was the moderator. Along with you know, the work we do as an association here, we lead two very active coalitions. On the water side, we have a harbor maintenance tax coalition for Hit the Mark campaign. For funding for dredging and spending down the harbor maintenance tax funds. And then on the land side, we lead the freight, or we chair the Freight Stakeholder Coalition. It's 19 national stakeholders. You can see by their logos who they are. It's a very diverse group. They are the planners, the users, and the providers of the transportation system. And we have weighed in on the last 4 reauthorization bills, and we work very closely with the authorizing and appropriation committees on freight issues. Roger touched on most of this as far as, you know, the role that ports play in the economy. We try not to be silent. I mean, most of our members are very active in their communities. We try to channel that here in Washington. But just real quickly, the cargo moving through our U.S. ports generate 13 million jobs. Over 1/4 of the U.S. economy is accounted for by international trade. 99% of overseas trade goes through America's seaports. And then ports actively generate more than $200 billion in federal, state, and local tax revenues. So these are numbers that are hard to ignore. And we find that when we have an audience, people tend to listen. You know, as far as the 3 phases of ports and what we do, we start with the water side. And this typically what we advocate for is dredging and maintenance of the federal navigation channels. Then we have the inside the gates operational policies, and then we have landside, and that is, you know, connecting freight and the ports to the surface transportation network and moving freight into the port for exports and then out into the country for imports. Today I'm going to focus more on the surface transportation landside policies that we are looking at. To begin with, I mean, ports, our footprint is getting bigger. It's expanding, and there's a lot of reasons driving this. I mean, certainly most of you have probably heard about the larger vessels that are now coming into our ports. They're really testing the capacity of our channels and also the terminal capacity. We are also pushing a lot of this increased freight movement is pushing a lot of our freight movement outside the gates in terms of how we operate. What's driving this is the increasing populations in metropolitan areas and then overall greater trade volumes. And Roger laid out some of the numbers, and I'll touch on that a little bit later, but I think at this point, numbers don't mean as much. I think it's the pictures that are being created with increased trade. The impact is moving beyond the port gates. And by that I mean, now more than ever, what we're hearing from our members is that we need to really be connected to the surface transportation network, and we need cleaner and more efficient connections. And that includes highway connectors and on-dock rail. 73% of our members have on-dock rail, and they say it's a vital part of not only how they grow, but how they are moving freight out into the country right now. We are also seeing that we have a more of an integrated port network, and this is coming in many forms. One is our ports are using more resources or more intermodal resources. Marine highways are becoming more and more active. I think Roger mentioned a barge project that he's working on with Virginia, and I know that Jeff will probably mention that. And then also we're seeing a lot of reliance on distribution centers outside our gates. And this is really kind of expanding our freight network and freeing it up a little bit, but also placing new demands on it. Tiger. Roger mentioned Tiger. And from a port perspective, you know, we couldn't be happier with it. It's really kind of been a catalyst for ports. It's brought us into the planning network, or the planning world with MPOs and COGS. Since 2009, Marin has administered 39 projects worth $500 million, but there's been other projects that have been administered by FHWA that have also, you know, been intermodal and have, you know, helped with the freight network. One of the things that I think is very important with ports when we're investing in Tiger and building projects is the additional leverage funding. Tiger alone for the MARAD projects have leveraged over $700 million in additional funding. And the other thing to remember about ports is we are kind of like the incubator for public-private partnerships. A lot of funding is already put in by the private sector. $46 billion over the next 5 years will be invested not only in ports but in the network, which leads me to MAP 21. MAP 21 really kind of took a lot of, you know, the good that Tiger has put out there from a freight network and port perspective, and really put an emphasis on the planning. And, you know, it's been important for ports to keep engaging. And I think it's been important for MAP 21 to kind of lay out this framework of, you know, state freight plans, you know, the encouragement to establish freight advisory committees, and then also have that process kind of in motion as we approach the next reauthorization bill. I just wanted to put this in here right now because I think, you know, I had mentioned earlier that, you know, populations, numbers don't matter as much. I mean, they matter. Population numbers matter. Freight numbers or import numbers matter. But when you just look at this picture and you think about how you're going to move this freight out into not only, you know, through or around the community, but out into the country, how can you not plan for that? So I think, you know, the planning provisions have been really important, no matter what the numbers are. I think just seeing a port, you know, seeing that day-to-day activity and seeing just the amount of freight that goes through all our ports, really, is, you know, it really gives you, I think, a greater understanding and perspective of kind of where we need to go with planning and funding a freight network. So building off the picture metaphor, we have conducted, we at the American Association of Port Authorities have conducted a survey on transportation freight infrastructure needs. We have surveyed, we basically got almost 100% of response from our members, and we focused on three main areas, planning, investments, and financing. And the purpose really is to, you know, kind of set the course for the next reauthorization bill and kind of lay out kind of what, from a port industry perspective, kind of where the needs are, what we need, and, you know, how we can, you know, how, you know, how we can move forward. So from a planning perspective, and these are preliminary results, 67% of our ports have worked with MPOs or Council of Governments, or are working with our MPOs and Council of Governments. 75% of our ports have developed or participated in the development of our statewide freight plan. My understanding is that there's right now USDOT has 42 state freight plans, and then also 69% of our ports have worked or are part of a local freight advisory committee, and you know, which leads us to intermodal connectors. And one of the things that, you know, our members are very, very interested in is how do we really kind of feel efficiency into the freight network? And usually that starts with intermodal connectors. And, you know, many of you may have heard the last Talking Freight call or webinar where we were given an update on a freight connector study that MARAD and FHWA is conducting. The last time that they did do a study was in 2000. And one of the things that I wanted to just highlight here is that a lot has changed since 2000. Between 2000 and 2013, the volume of containers entering into the U.S. grew by 50%. And at the same time, we've seen record population growth in metropolitan areas where ports, you know, generally are. It's grown by 33 million people. So the connector system that we have right now connecting our ports it needs to be updated, and it's really being used or abused, I should say. So as far as investment in our freight board and our connectors, you know, over the next decade, we are looking, you know, our ports are looking at investing in intermodal connectors or needing to invest in their intermodal connectors. And one of our survey questions asked, you know, what kind of investment do we need? And nearly 81% of our port members surveyed said that a minimum investment of $10 million in their connectors is necessary. 31% of the survey said $100 million is needed. 35% of port authorities said that congestion on connectors negatively impacted their port's productivity by 25 to 50%. We also asked about projects. And again, these are preliminary. But basically, from, you know, a port industry perspective, looking outside the gate or looking from a port, we have about $18.7 billion in projects of national and regional significant projects, $6.7 billion in intermodal projects, and almost $2 billion in Tiger projects that the industry is looking at to be to fund or to build. Financing gaps. One of the interesting things about the survey that we found out is that as much as on-dock rail is a key piece for ports and their future, only 13% of our members have really accessed or utilized RIF. Even more surprising is only 8% have accessed and utilized TIFIA. What we did see is that there is a strong interest in P3s. I mean, I think, you know, you could almost categorize ports as a P3 incubator. These, you know, 34% are using or planning to use P3s. 40% identified private activity bonds as a source that they've used in the past. And then 61% said that they're using other, and that is yet to be defined. But I think, as Roger said, with the Build America initiative, that there's been a great response to that from ports, and I think ports are very, more so than most modes, are very adaptable to different financing options or opportunities. Investment is going to continue to be critical, and I think, just to kind of summarize, ports are already investing $46 billion over the next 5 years. Certainly need the government to uphold and be a partner as we build out the freight network. And we've seen that the private sector certainly has a role to play in P3s with ports. And I think there's a good opportunity moving forward to leverage additional funding, not just typical federal funds. And then finally, just as from an AAPA landside freight port priorities, as we're looking at the next reauthorization bill, here are some of our priorities, and here's what we're looking at as we move towards the next reauthorization bill. Designation of gateway and corridors, identification of connectors and primary freight network, expertise in maritime freight planning should be a part of every DOT. I think Roger touched on that. I think it's important to have that understanding or that expertise on the state level. And certainly short sea shipping or America's marine highways. I mean, that's going to be, I think, a growing area as well. Dedicated funding, we feel is vitally important. The success of Tiger really illustrates that on more levels, not just the funding, but also the planning and leveraging additional resources. We also think that Port Authority should be eligible to apply directly for funding if there is going to be a freight program. And then funding for connectors and intermodal projects, first and last mile projects, those are continue to be top priorities around the country with many of our members. And then also funding for projects of national regional significance or a larger discretionary program that can really kind of hit on some of those gateway projects. And then finally, the TIFIA program, certainly keeping that, but making it more port friendly or accessible. And then other strong financing options that ports can utilize. That's my presentation. But there's just one other thing I wanted to touch on, or actually kind of ask a question to the group. I think there's also a lot of state work being done on freight funds, and I know that Louisiana and Texas has programs, and I'd be interested if anyone has information on a state program where there is freight funds available that could leverage potentially federal funds, and hearing more about that. And then I also think that certainly, I love the series and what Barbara and Roger have talked about as being the integrator. And I think, certainly the FRA or the RIF program, I think that would be another great opportunity to kind of pull these in together for another webinar. And with that, I'll hand it over back to Nicole.
Thank you, John. We'll now move on to Ben D'Alba of the California State Transportation Agency.
Thank John for that wonderful presentation, and I'll actually touch on some of the state funding programs in my presentation here. As the presentation gets loaded up, I just want to say thanks again for inviting me to participate on this webinar. It's an honor to be up here speaking to all of you today. I've learned a lot from these webinars over the years, and so it's an honor to be giving back to the webinar today. As been said, I'm Ben D'Alba. I'm the Assistant Secretary for Rail to Ports at the California State Transportation Agency. And my objective today is really to provide some insight on how California has integrated maritime into its overall state planning or its California Freight Mobility Plan, as well as touch on some how the Strong Ports Program fits into California and possibly how it can fit into your state too.
I identified some key points here that
I noted, everybody. I scrolled through them.
Really explain how California
and I guess when I closed it, it stopped at the end.
Right. Yes, I think one of the things that
one is
she hasn't, I don't know,
of course, how
you
are new transportation
already up in the background, not really in the background, but
as well
memorized,
as new
so that you just pull up on that when the presenter comes up, so you don't have to worry. And mind you, that's one thing game to play too. Maybe that's
that
maybe she just did with something
maritime
just keeping in mind if
we went through the planning process for our state freight plan. And then thirdly, I'll touch on a history of successful maritime investments that really propelled and provided a foundation for the plan that we just completed, the freight plan that we completed just at the end of 2014. And then towards the end, I will touch on a few things that I think played a strong role in or how strong ports really played a role or can play a role in California as we move forward for planning sort of this integrated system that we've been touched on in a few presentations earlier, and how do we integrate maritime into the broader picture of transportation as a whole in California. This is a picture of the San Francisco Transbay Terminal and or the Transbay Center. It's in the downtown San Francisco. It's not complete. This is clearly a rendering of what the finished product will look like. When it's complete, though, it'll house 11 transit operators within one facility, including the California High Speed Rail. Right now, it's just a big hole in the ground. Some people actually refer to it as the Big Dig, but. But with the point here is this building represents the thinking here in California and it sounds like with the rest of the nation on what does this really mean for maritime, and that it's integration. This facility is the quintessential terminal or multimodal terminal that integrates multi-modes into one facility. At the top, you can see people enjoying an outdoor park. The level below, there's a bus terminal. And just below them is a robust retail facility. And then below, underground, you have intercity high-speed rail as well as commuter trains all coming into the same terminal. So this is really the movement California or the path California is taking on transportation, and how do we really plan a system to work as a whole and to be seamless and integrated for the citizens of California. So really the task or the lead on taking on this effort of integration is the California State Transportation Agency. And this is no easy task, but Governor Brown really recognized the importance of having a single integrated agency that is responsible for coordinating all of our transportation agencies into one agency. So we're a new agency. We were just created in 2013, and prior to the transportation agency was a large cabinet agency that wasn't solely focused on transportation and had a number of other portfolios within the secretary's purview. So this is a welcome change here in California, and an agency that really brings a much needed voice to transportation at the cabinet level here in California. So just real quick, this is the mission of the agency, and it's to develop and coordinate the policies and programs of the state's transportation entities to achieve the state's mobility, safety, and air quality objectives from its transportation system. And we execute that mission through our transportation entities and departments here in California. As you can see, the Department of Transportation at the top, Caltrans, is one of our constituent agencies. And we also have a plethora of others that we worked with. As a whole, the secretary here is responsible for about 40,000 employees and an annual budget of about $19 billion.
So kind of going on this integration theme, one of the first efforts that the new agency took on was to give an external review of the Department of Transportation here in California, and it was to take on a fresh look and how to really make the department more effective and better able to serve the people of California. Prior to the review, Caltrans has been largely focused on one mode, and that's highway building, highway expansion, the maintenance and operations, and never hadn't really taken a larger look at the bigger picture in California in terms of integrating other modes of transportation and how that may affect California's mobility. So as you can see, the old mission statement here for Caltrans was Caltrans improves mobility across California, and then one of the recommendations that came out of our external review, which was completed last year, suggested to create a new mission, and so Caltrans did adopt that new mission, and now it reflects sort of this new path the department has taken, and that's to provide a safe, sustainable, integrated, and efficient transportation system to enhance California's economy and livability. And so that means really encompassing highway, rail, maritime, and airports, as well as pedestrians, and integrating them all into one system. And it's not surprisingly enough, but pretty important, I think the first plan that was completed under the new mission that from Caltrans was the California Freight Mobility Plan. It was the department's first stab at really developing this multimodal plan that encompassed and incorporated all the modes, and they're represented here in the pictures. You can see the rail, the highway, the air cargo, and the marine as well. So many of you may be aware of our plan, and I'm sure that the U.S. Department of Transportation is, because we submitted to them earlier in the year, but may not be so much aware of sort of the inner workings or some of the insights that went in and efforts that went into really creating the plan. And it's, I would say, probably the biggest accomplishment here, other than just completing the plan, was that the plan was written in-house. This was done within the Department of Transportation, written by our freight team, and I think you may have heard from the gentleman in December, Mr. Bruce DeTerra, and he was fantastic and really knowledgeable in this area, which goes on to the fact that the staff, if you're going to write it in-house, you got to be educated on the supply chain, and during the process, and even before of the drafting of the plan, the staff within the department visited supply chain facilities, key intermodal facilities, the ports within California to get a better understanding of how the system really works and how do all the nodes within the supply chain interact with one another. And I think that was key. And they also educate their staff by holding annual workshops or sort of week-long training focus on freight and the supply chain so they can better equip themselves for planning in the future. And then, of course, Seattle, we consulted our California Freight Advisory Committee. They were a key player in the whole planning process, and I want to get into that here a little bit. So just kind of getting into the meat of the plan and actually kind of showing you all what it means to have this multimodal plan here in California and sort of the accomplishments of Caltrans in developing it, is we had to identify all of the key freight facilities, and that's what this map represents, minus the highways. If we included the highways, this map would sort of be a spaghetti mess, but this is rail network, the seaports, the airports, as well as the marine highways here, which was a huge feat for the department, considering their past of being focused on highways. They hadn't considered marine routes in the past. So We identified what we call the Marine 580, which is along the pointer here, which go into our inland ports of the Port of Stockton and the Port of West Sacramento. I just lost a bit of my connectivity. And then we also identified the M5 highway off of the coast of the California. And we did that particularly because it's important that we identify where the cargo is coming through our gateways so we can adapt and plan on the land side. Okay, I'm back on here. And that's when we really dug into identifying our corridors and the important corridors that connect to these gateways with the seaports as well as to the rest of the nation and internationally and to Mexico. As we heard from John, we have these larger vessels that are calling at our ports and they're dumping larger amounts of cargo, which is putting an increased strain on our transportation system. So it's, I believe as John said, it's difficult to, or how can you not plan for such an increased volume in cargo on the land side? We have to be cognizant of what's taking place in our global gateways and plan accordingly to the rest of the infrastructure. And that's what Caltrans, I think, has done really well here, is they went ahead and tiered the most important or the highest or the key interregional and interstate connectors, corridor connectors on both the highway system and the rail networks. And I'm not going to get into a whole lot of detail here, but feel free to follow up if you want to understand a little bit more on how we tiered the system. But that's pretty much the meat and potatoes of the California Freight Mobility Plan and the importance of connecting how we work with the maritime ports. But continuing on, how do we really get there is, I guess, the bigger question, and that's working through the California Freight Advisory Committee and with our regional metropolitan planning agencies, the MPOs, the regional transportation planning agencies. We have a couple or a handful of very large MPOs in California representing the Northern California, the Central California, and the Southern California regions. And they individually can put together their own set of freight plans and identify freight projects within their plans. And they participate in the Freight Advisory Committee. And we also have individual seaports participating on the committee, as well as the California Association of Port Authorities that is represented there as well. And I think the important connection between all of these entities and at the Freight Advisory Committee is that we put our chief deputy at California Department of Transportation as the chair of the California Freight Advisory Committee. So he is the central hub, if you will, between all of these organizations and collecting the input through that advisory committee and really disseminates that through the department and down into the planning staff. I think that's important and maybe one that could be noted through the rest of the states in the union, but to have somebody of that prominence to run your Freight Advisory Committee, I think speaks volumes and increases the integrity of the committee itself. But again, so we work with all of the stakeholders. There are more than just maritime industry on the Freight Advisory Committee. We have environmental justice, communities, and so on and so forth. And I will mention that we, after the majority of our committee meetings, we do a site tour, much like we had Caltrans educates their own staff when writing the plan. We make it an effort to educate our freight stakeholders who may not have the opportunity to visit some of these freight facilities to go out there and so they could see what actually takes place and the importance they have on our economy. So lastly, on my keys to successful maritime integration is a strong history of maritime investments. And John had asked the question about which programs do states have that can leverage federal funds? This is our bread and butter for freight investments, and it took part in 2006 when California voters passed the general obligation bond, which at the amount of $20 billion, and $2 billion went into a fund called the Trade Corridor Improvement Fund, which supported over $7 billion in freight investments. So that was a leverage of about $5 billion just by putting $2 billion into a program. And a lot of those projects that we funded leveraged Tiger funding as well as other sources of funding. So we've had tremendous success in this program, the Trade Corridor Improvement Fund. And like I said earlier, it was really the catalyst to and the foundation for what we're doing today because of its success. And it's really credited for bringing together the stakeholders prior to our Freight Advisory Committee because they had to work together to get their funding priorities in order when they were receiving these funds. And we actually did a survey, just a quick raise of the hands at our last previous Freight Advisory Committee of who was in attendance that worked on the previous allocation of these funds. And there was a good strong representation of people who worked in this past program still working today on freight issues in California. And then, of course, we have the Tiger funding has been pretty successful here in California, not only working to fund infrastructure projects at our ports, but also supporting some of the air quality objectives that we're working on here in California, such as clean shore power or coal power, coal ironing. So what does this all mean? And I mean, when we integrate maritime into the statewide freight plan, we really are trying to get projects like this one that you're looking at now, and this is what we call the Oakland Global Project at the Port of Oakland, and we're looking here and the highway just above are to the Bay Bridge and to San Francisco, and the city's off to your right. But this is a prime example of a project that involved countless stakeholders to develop a world-class infrastructure project that not only has a robust near-dock rail facility, but also a state-of-the-art warehousing on the port premises, just as you see, just off of the port here. But this takes tremendous coordination, and we also have the highway connectors that were mentioned previously. I mean, this type of project takes a lot of coordination, and this is why we have to put it in our planning so we can plan for it, and then we can get similar projects throughout the rest of our maritime ports in California. And just to give you an example of some of the partners that were involved in this, it's pretty much at every level. We have the Department of Transportation with the Tiger Funds, the Metropolitan Planning Commission, which is the regional MPO in Oakland, played a humongous role in securing some of the state funds, and that again comes from the Trade Corridor Improvement Fund that I mentioned earlier. And then, of course, the Port of Oakland also is a partner, obviously, as well as the City of Oakland. And then we also have private stakeholders.
If it's an issue that they can't stay on, what we do
maritime is really a
questions, and then we follow
meeting ground for
afterwards
these
with
reasons
the
and working with
the questions
public
that
and the private
yet.
Industry.
And
so the Oakland Global is a wonderful example of collaboration and the importance to plan at every level
too often, but
in order to get successful projects that are going to advance the industry and allow for a smooth integration between the shipping, the rail, and trucking. So just to kind of touch again on the end about where strong ports can really help, particularly here in California, it's really connecting the stakeholders. I think they've already done some wonderful work like that. The Port of Stockton and the Port of Oakland were working on a barge service on the inland and waterway on the M580. I know the MARA played an important role on coordinating the right stakeholders who would be using such a service to make it happen. So I think similar efforts like that, strong ports can be a huge help. as well as focus on ports that with fewer resources. And it was mentioned earlier, but I had a conversation with one of our partners here in California who works at a port. You know, we were talking, and the ports of Los Angeles, Long Beach, and Oakland all have robust planning staff, but there may not be other, or our other ports may not have such large planning staff that can do a lot of these forecastings. But I think the Strong Ports program can be really beneficial to those ports if they're proactive in reaching out to them. And then lastly, I think MARAD has done some of this in the past, but can really bring the national and international perspectives into state planning and regional planning, where sometimes we become too focused on what's happening within our borders. I think Strong Ports can open up that picture and give us the right tools to plan for the global supply chain and what is taking place on a national level and where the nation is heading, in which direction. But there's a relatively new challenge, and I want to bring this up, that we're taking part here in California, and that's freight policy integration. So now that our transportation agency has a freight mobility plan that's focused on infrastructure, we're looking at ways to incorporate that plan into a broader policy discussion with our sister agencies at the California Air Resources Board, the California Energy Commission, and our Economic Development Agency here in California. And how do we coordinate all of the policies within those agencies into one freight policy that touches on air quality and public health, increased energy security and system resiliency, that supports logistics growth and job creation, as well as enhances livability among freight corridors. And I'm interested in how MARAD and the Strong Ports Program can play an integral role as we move forward with this broader freight policy here in California. So with that, I ask you all, if you have any questions, please feel free to reach out to me. That's my email address there, and then I'm always available by phone. So with that, thank you very much.
Thank you, Ben. We'll now move on to Rob Case of the Hampton Roads Transportation Planning Organization. Rob?
Yes, good afternoon. I'll be talking about how my MPO helps freight move. Started with the last slide, so okay, here we go. I'll be talking in 4 points, first sort of introductory, then how we identify and test projects here at the MPO, and then talking about rail and highway interaction and promoting freight projects. So first, I work for the Hampton Roads Transportation Planning Organization, which is the MPO for what we call Hampton Roads, Virginia, which is southeastern Virginia. You may be familiar with Norfolk and Newport News and Virginia Beach, all included in that area. And we have one of the largest container ports on the East Coast, which Jeff will talk about in a minute, and almost 2 million in population. Largest naval base in the world, and I think the largest coal loading facility in the world. So one of the things we've done recently is created this Freight Transportation Advisory Committee, FTAC, and it advises the board that I work for, and it's comprised of freight professionals. So what you might think of as the private side. So you have trucking companies like Givens, and then railroad company, Norfolk Southern, one of the largest in the nation, and then two that you might not think of as freight people, but Cannon and Walmart. They need to move a lot of freight in order to stay in business. So as far as staffing the FTAC goes, it's a little different than our other committees in that I don't directly staff it. That's done by Jeff Florin, who you're going to hear from next, and he works for the Virginia Port Authority. And so he's got to do the stuff that we ordinarily would do, which is to, you know, prepare agendas and provide the meeting space and find new members. And then three things here at the end that I'll talk more about later on, which is a video and a toll study and a freight summit that Jeff put together and his organization funded. So one of the things we do here, though, as MPO staff, is we identify and test all kinds of projects, but including freight projects. And so here's something we did a few years ago where we looked at the highways that had the highest truck volumes, and then we, you know, forecasted traffic and analyzed the intersections and made recommendations, because two of our main routes are U.S. highways and therefore have some signals on them. Another thing we've done to try to help the port is a larger regional freight study, which we do about every 4 years. And not only do we look at the amount of material that's imported and exported through the port, but we enumerated truck delays and then recommended a major highway project to address those truck delays. Another project that we've done, and by the way, all these are available on our website, and you'll see that at the end. We sort of built on the previous study by looking at future truck volumes and 20 years down the road, so to speak. And we were able to do that because our VDOT, our state transportation department, had improved our four-step model, our transportation model, to include trucks specifically and separate from autos, and then also to do a time of day analysis as opposed to 24-hour analysis. So, and through that process, we added the ports as a special truck generator because they, you know, produce more trucks than your average industrial area. And so through that, we were able to forecast trucks and to see where the problems would be in the future. Now, why did we do that? Well, we used that information as input for our project prioritization tool for our long-range transportation plan. That's what our LRTP stands for, long-range transportation plan. And I'll talk more about that tool in a minute. So, in other words, we don't just do these studies just to sit on the shelf, but use their output as input for this tool, which selects projects and then promotes them in that way. So, but before I get to that, I want to talk about a study we did of a hypothetical inland port, and the gentleman from California mentioned some inland ports. And we have one here, and we were thinking about that might be valuable to build another one on the edge of our metropolitan area, and that way containers that ordinarily would go by truck to and from the port could go by rail out to the edge of the to and from the edge of the metropolitan area, and therefore remove the trucks from the, you know, highway congestion. Although of course there may be many other reasons to build this such a project, we found that the impact on regional congestion would be small. Then here, this is back to that prioritization tool that I mentioned before. And so, of course, one of the way projects get promoted is by being in the long-range transportation plan. And our the tool measures all kinds of projects on all kinds of things, you know, economic impact and congestion impact and safety and that sort of thing. But we also give projects more points if they improve access to the port. And that's what you can see here in these three bullets, the way that projects would get more points if they do that. Then the thing we try to do for Map 21 is try to get ahead of the curve on this national freight network, which you may have heard about, and the National Freight Strategic Plan. And so we did some advanced work on that, and our goal was to position ourselves for future freight infrastructure funding, which was mentioned by one of the previous presenters that may be in the new legislation. Then I want to talk also quickly, and I'm almost done, but talk about the FTAC specifically. They advise us on all those projects that we did, those studies that we did, and they also have done several other specific things. The first thing you see there is a freight video, which the port managed and funded, hired somebody to create this professional video, which promoted and teaches about the importance of freight. And as somebody said, it's sort of a silent, freight can be silent, not speak for itself. And the second thing there, we had this, the Virginia Freight Transportation Summit, brought a lot of people together, and that was managed and funded by the port, Virginia Port Authority. And the third one being working with us in our process, our long-range transportation plan process, which was mentioned, and identifying freight beneficial projects for us to consider. And then finally, we're in the middle of a study done by a consultant to determine the tipping point for toll amounts and their impact on trucks and the economy. So that's some of the stuff that we're doing to coordinate with the port. And so you can find all that stuff on our website. And I can answer questions by email, which I think is on the first slide, and if not, I'm rcase@hrtpo.org.
Okay, thank you, Rob. Our final presentation will be given by Jeff Florin of the Virginia Port Authority. Jeff?
Good afternoon and good morning, everyone. I have the pleasure of being part of this seminar. And also, as a partner with everyone who has spoken so far, with the exception of California, and would love to partner with them to get into some of their big coffers of money that they have out there. As the slide comes up, I'm going to start talking about the Port of Virginia's master plan. That'll come up shortly, but every port has a master plan. And what ports do is they'll look at cargo forecasts at the national level, at the coast level, at a regional level, and then bring it down to the state level just to see what's a reasonable expectation that cargo will come into the port. And we look at that demand, and then we want to develop plans to build capacity so that we can stay ahead, always stay ahead of demand. There we go. But as it says here, we can't do it alone. And the theme throughout all the presentations so far has been strong ports require integrated planning amongst a vast variety of stakeholders and partners. So what's shown here is the three elements to be a successful port, and I think John from AAPA showed this. Deep water is essential. That's our driveway or highway, so to speak, from open sea into the port. The water's not uniformly deep across the bottom, but you have to create these channels, and these channels can be long. Our channel is 18 miles, you know, out to open sea, and then it's deep water from there to wherever the ships are going. Good port infrastructure, this is to facilitate, again, as John had showed on one of his slides, the efficient transfer of cargo from the ship to the inland transportation system, either to a truck, a train, or in some cases to a barge. And then finally, good inland transportation connections so that the cargo can get from the port to destination, or, you know, in the reverse, from origins in the United States to a port. So again, we're talking about integrated planning, which is a key element to be successful. Ports used to primarily focus on what was going on inside the gate. So we wanted to make sure that our infrastructure was built with plenty of capacity in it so that we could handle anything that was thrown at us. And then we would look at the water side, you know, the channels. That's traditionally what we've done, and it's still a primary focus. But as we've been talking, to be successful now, ports require broader planning and a lot more outside-the-gate coordination, if you will. And the MARAD Strong Ports program encourages partnerships to, you know, to help with these matters. Partnerships leverage those three elements that I talked about, deep water, port infrastructure, and the inland transportation connections, as shown here. Partnerships with the, and I'll talk more in detail about these, Corps of Engineers is the one that you, is the organization that you partner with for maintaining channels, deepening channels, constructing channels. We partner with railroads, trucking community, various federal, state, private investors for port infrastructure, as was mentioned, P3 projects. And then for inland transportation connections, we'll, you know, we'll partner with the various federal agencies, the TPO, which is the Hampton Roads Metropolitan Planning Organization, the MPOs in Richmond,
Ben,
as well as Northern Virginia. And then state agencies, our state highway department, our Department of Rail, and then finally with localities.
Okay. I emailed John.
This is a close-up slide showing the Hampton Roads area, which is located in southeastern Virginia, just to help orient you to that. Let me grab the arrow here. This structure right here is the Chesapeake Bay Bridge Tunnel. To the right over here is the Atlantic Ocean, the Chesapeake Bay, and then these are our deep water channels coming into the port. And as I mentioned, they're 18 miles from our terminals, which are located here, out to open sea. And you can see the channel goes up to Newport News, and then as it gets further inland up towards Richmond, we'll talk a little bit about there. It gets shallower, it goes down to 25-foot depth. And then on down into Chesapeake, down in the southern region here, and then that connects with the intercoastal waterway. The channels are 50 foot deep. We are just starting the process, the planning process, to deepen them to 55 feet so that we can stay ahead of post-Panamax ships and again, partnering with Corps of Engineers to do that. Port infrastructure. Terminal improvements often require innovative financing mechanism, and ports are never shy about helping to spend other people's money, TPOs, MPOs with various CMAC grants that we'll talk a little bit about. I mentioned the Virginia Department of Rail and Transportation. The state of Virginia has a very forward-thinking program called Rail Enhancement Funds, which will allow state money to be spent on private rail infrastructure if it can be demonstrated that there's a public benefit. So there's a test process to follow. Federal Tiger Grants, we were fortunate last year to have won one of those, and then the stimulus program back in 2009. So with regional financing assistance, we partnered with the TPO on various grants, which are briefly mentioned here. Port of Virginia Green Operator Program is it's a very similar to the program Cash for Clunkers for trucks. So We were fortunate to receive a CMAQ grant that would allow us to offer up to $20,000 to a trucker, if he would scrap his older vehicle and replace it with 2008 or newer technology. In Richmond, we were successful with the MPO up there to receive a grant for a mobile harbor crane, which is a large piece of equipment to transfer cargo from the barge, which we'll talk a little bit more about in a while, from the barge to the Port of Richmond. State financing assistance, the Rail Enhancement Fund program, we've been successful with a number of grants, again, that can demonstrate a public benefit. John talked about on-dock rail. Down here, the lower left is the NIT facility, which is an on-dock rail facility that takes cargo directly from the ship. We put it on a train and then on out the gates. In the center, it's a marshaling yard, which is used for making up trains. And then this is another shot of the on-dock rail yard. Federal financing assistance, I talked briefly about the Tiger Grant, which we were fortunate to win last year. This is a classic last-mile connection project that will connect to a new interstate connection that's being built at the end of NIT, Norfolk International Terminals, to provide a new gate infrastructure, which doubles the gate capacity at that facility. And then I mentioned the stimulus program back in 2009, which was used to build the median rail line, which is shown here, which you can see is in the middle of a state highway that was planned 20 years ago, waiting for this rail connection to be funded and built. And then finally, inland transportation connections, which is what I'll spend most of the time talking about, just to show some specific projects where you require integrated planning, financing, and project support at multiple levels to be successful. It's been discussed ports are challenged by increasing congestion, more cargo coming in, but communities around us are also growing. So it becomes a challenge to move that cargo through the communities without without disrupting the communities. The benefits are economic benefit to the localities, but the average citizen doesn't always realize the economic benefit if he's stuck with a train across the road or stuck traveling amongst a bunch of trucks, down his on the way to his home. So a few projects to talk about, a few sample projects. One of the things I guess that I've learned in being here for the past 10 years is there's no easy formula for a project, but I have learned that every project needs a champion, every champion needs multiple partners, and a large measure of persistence, because most of these projects take a decade or more to get through the system. So the first project, Heartland Corridor, in the lower right is the Port of Virginia. This was a coal route going through Virginia. This was a partnership between the entities that are shown there, a big one being the railroad, multiple states, the federal government. And the project trimmed 230 miles off the distance between the port and Chicago, which is a major hub, as you all know. James River Barge, another project with multiple partners, MARAD, Richmond MPO, the Hampton Roads TPO. The designation of this project is M64. And you can see in yellow here is I-64, which goes from the Port of Virginia up to Richmond to connect to 95. M-64 follows the James River. So from our deep water channels up the James River, this is a barge. It calls three times a week in Richmond, three times a week at Hampton Roads. It removes trucks off of I-64 and it's a green way of transporting cargo to Richmond as opposed to the highway.
So
I-564 connector is an intermodal connector that was talked about. Again, 64 connects out to 95, which is the major interstate north and south of the East Coast. You see 64 comes down, connects up to 564, which goes to the Navy base. The intermodal connector comes from 564 right to the front gate of the Navy base, largest Navy base in the world. Which is shown here, and the Norfolk International Terminals, which is shown here. So it's a classic first mile, last mile connector that required multiple partners. Rob talked about the FTAC, which is a, it's rather unique in that it is 100% private freight movers that provide advice and recommendation to the TPO, to the decision makers, through Rob's organization. And then some future projects, Port of Virginia Gateway, this is one that we've been working on for 4 or 5 years. It will connect that large Craney Island terminal. It's a road rail connector, which will tie into one of the state routes, that median rail project that I showed a couple slides before. The railroad continues on down out to the Heartland Corridor, and then a couple of grade separations in Suffolk. But multiple partners, it's a $500 million plus or minus project, and it will take several years, to get that one into the system. And then the final project is the I-44. It's not a designated project yet, but multiple partners again, VDOT, TPO, FTAC, two states, which goes from Hampton Roads and connects Raleigh. So our two municipalities are fairly unique on the East Coast in that we're the only large municipalities of our scale that have one interstate connection coming in and out of them. So this connector will provide a secondary interstate, and it provides a good connection between the port in northeastern North Carolina, which is a large market for us. And in conclusion, strong ports really highlights many of the things that the port has been doing over the past number of years to be successful. And again, it's a model that's absolutely required for any of these projects to make it through the system. That concludes my presentation, and hopefully there's time left for questions.